Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Okama Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Valentine's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You can reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. It is Friday, February 8th, 2013. Governor Rick Snyder takes pride in talking about Michigan's brightening economy. The governor laid out a $50 billion spending plan yesterday that was higher than last year's. It calls for spending increases in education, health care, and public safety, among other areas. The administration also calls for higher gasoline and diesel taxes and vehicle registration fees to help pay for over $1 billion in repairs to Michigan roads that the governor wants. And joining us today on Current State, the lead author of that spending plan, Michigan State Budget Director John Nixon. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Good to see you. And also joining us, East Lansing State Rep Sam Singh of the 69th House District. Sam is the only mid-Michigan rep on the House Appropriations Committee. Welcome back, Sam.
Thank you.
Director Nixon, from 5 miles up, what were your key parameters for this budget? I mean, what limits, what boundaries did you know you wanted to stay within?
Well, as far as the budget, we just wanted to create a budget. We wanted to stay within our available revenue, but we also knew there were some big issues that we needed to tackle. We knew that with the Medicaid expansion that we're recommending support of, the Affordable Care Act is coming. We knew that a decision needed to be made there. As far as road funding, we knew that we needed to do something bold there as well. And then we wanted to make education and higher education some priorities in the budget as well. So we took our available means that we had and we crafted the best budget proposal that we could. It's several months of looking at the data, looking, you know, doing analysis on the budget. And we think we've come up with a very, very well thought out budget for the future of Michigan.
But was, for example, a bump in education spending, was that on your radar months ago? I mean, did you know months ago that you'd be able to pull this off?
Oh, absolutely, Mark. I mean, when we came in 2 years ago, we were facing perpetual deficits, growing liabilities, and we made some tough decisions. And the reason we made the tough decisions that year was so we could get the budget in equilibrium so we could start making strategic investments back in the system. And education certainly at the top of that list with higher education, some of these other programs.
Representative Sam Singh, you called for a bump in early childhood, K-12, and higher education. You got one. Are you satisfied?
Well, I think when we take a look at the overall budget, it's a mixed bag. There are definitely a number of positive things, and I always like to lead off with that, especially when you take a look at early childhood funding as well as the expansion of Medicaid that was proposed here. And, you know, we know that Obamacare is going to be here, and we're pleased that the governor has listened to the advocates who've been asking for these types of changes. When we take a look at the other parts of the budget, especially the K through 12, as well as the higher education budget, you know, we took extreme cuts 2 years ago, and we're not back at that baseline. And I think we could have done more within this budget and looking at our priorities for K through 12 and higher education funding.
John Nixon, what specific considerations finally determined that it would be 2%? For education. Can you go a little deeper there with us?
Well, yeah. I mean, when you bring together the budget, it's really tough. When you have to put together a complete budget plan that we do, and again, we do it all at once, you've got to look at all the priorities, and you're bound by the revenue that you have. And so when you put together, you've got the issues with your current services baseline, you've got the issues that you know you've got to fund and take care of in the budget, and then you look at what you have available to spend and you prioritize your spending. And so we didn't go into the budget saying we want a 2% increase in education. We went into the budget saying, you know, we want to meet the obligations that we need to meet. We want to increase education funding. We want to increase as much as we can. And so as we put the budget together, we decided that that's where we wanted to spend the money, and we made those investments, and we came up with the budget we did.
But increasing education, could you say increasing education funding was on your short list of priorities?
I can say it was at the top of our short list of priorities.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it was right at the top, for sure.
You said on Wednesday that $130 million more funding for the Great Start Readiness Program would more than double the number of at-risk four-year-olds that are enrolled in public preschools. To what extent would that increased investment cover at-risk preschoolers in the state? Is that just a very modest increase, or is that a significant move in the right direction?
No, a lot of people felt like the need out there that was unmet is about $130 million. And so we actually put $65 million in this year's budget, $65 million in next year's budget for a fully loaded $130 million ongoing for next year. So we felt like we made a huge step in the right direction there, as that will help these kids who are at risk be able to perform better in the K-12 system.
Sam Singh, care to comment?
Well, no, I do agree. I mean, I think this was a good first step. Obviously, we could have been bolder taking a look at the need that's right here in the first year. But again, I think we have to take a look at the comprehensive part. We are, especially as you take a look at the business tax cuts that happened 2 years ago, one of my critiques is that, you know, we gave blanket tax cuts to all these businesses, and not all of them are actually creating jobs. You know, I take a look at law firms as being one of the biggest things that I look at. One of my friend's firms would have paid $1.2 million worth of taxes, you know, under this recent year. But because they're LLC, they don't pay any business taxes. And unfortunately, those dollars aren't going into education. So we've made some budgetary decisions and some taxing decisions, including the income tax reduction last year, which could have been going towards higher education, K-12 education. Business Leaders of Michigan, you know, came up with a report that says we're $1 billion short over the next 10 years on higher education. So if we really want to position our universities and our kids in a global economy, we need to be investing at a higher level. And I think some of the decisions that we've made over the last 2 years have not necessarily created new jobs and hasn't invested in positioning our universities in a global economy.
John Nixon, what do you make of that critique?
Well, I think it's easy to pick out and isolate one issue. But when we came in, you know, we were facing a billion and a half dollar structural deficit. Michigan was broke. We had a tax system that wasn't working. We had a job-killing business tax. We had a taxation system where those who were benefiting from the system weren't paying into the system. And so we had to reset the table, and we knew we had to make some tough decisions. And so we came in, we put the budget in structural balance, we started reforming our long-term liabilities, which ultimately will create a long-term structurally sustainable path for Michigan. We know that it's going to take some time to get there, but we think that we've now got a tax system that will create jobs. Things are improving that we're seeing out there, and we have an improving economy. And that's why we're able to make some strategic investments this year.
We're talking with State Budget Director John Nixon and East Lansing State Rep Sam Singh here on Current State on WKAR. For higher ed, the budget again contains a provision that calls for colleges and universities to hold tuition increases to under 4% next fiscal year, as well as meet performance standards for graduation rates, research and development, et cetera, or lose part of their state aid. Are you okay with that, Sam Singh?
Well, I think we do need to have tuition constraint, and it's one of the metrics. And I do believe that some of the metrics that have been created are a good step forward for universities. But again, I have to go back. We made our public universities take a 15% cut 2 years ago. They got a 3% increase last year, a 2% increase on that this year. We're not even back to that base level. And again, we have to invest more dollars. Every year we don't invest in higher education means our institutions are less competitive than others across the country. And to me, that's the large conversation. Even when we get into some of the details, you know, graduate medical education, you know, we're here at Michigan State University. We've got, you know, two great, you know, medical schools. And we've zeroed out that budget here in the governor's plan. I know from the Appropriations Committee, they were successful last time putting it back in. You know, I'm going to be fighting for that as well within this budget. But again, we know we have a shortage of doctors and nurses as we take a look at that, and we should be investing in areas like that type of revenue.
Care to comment specifically about
higher
ed?
I don't know if we zeroed out graduate medical education. Certainly there are some tough choices that have to be made. Again, when we came in, we couldn't afford the path that we were on. And so as we're building the budget now, we're making those investments back in. Would we have liked to have done more in higher education? Absolutely. But we're in a position where the pie's only so big. And so, again, it's easy to pick out one area and say we need more money. I mean, you know what, we've got a lot of people out there who, a lot of people think we've gone too far. There are a lot of people who think we haven't gone far enough. Would we like to do more? Absolutely. But I think the key here is that as we're investing money back in the system, we're doing it tied to outcomes. No longer are we just spreading money to spread money. You know, we've got performance funding in the K-12 system. We've got performance money, best practice money in the higher education system. Same thing with state agencies, our revenue sharing. And what these do is they help bend long-term cost trends. And so we're actually, you know, pretty proud with what we've come up with. We know that it's a long-term process. We didn't get into the problem that we got into overnight. Neither did the governor or I create the problem. But we certainly think we're trying to solve a problem and deal with the state of Michigan finances and put it on a long-term path that's going to create jobs and provide a stable living environment for our Michiganders.
Now, the administration also calls for raising gas and diesel fuel taxes from 19 cents a gallon to 33 cents. It's been years since either of those have been touched. The governor also wants an increase in vehicle registration fees. John Nixon, how much of that $1.2 billion the administration would like to see going to roads would those increases pay for?
That's the whole package.
That's $1.2 billion.
Yeah, the revenue is basically a gas and diesel tax increase and the registration fee increase. And that's a critical increase. As you know, it's not a real politically popular thing to do. But again, as we've looked at the infrastructure in our state, we haven't invested in the infrastructure over the past many, many years. Our roads are not the best roads out there. We lose lives on our roads every year. And we're losing $3 million a day in the value of our roads because we're not keeping them up. In 10 years, we're going to have a failed system. We're not going to be able to move people around and move goods around. And so we know the decisions the governor is making today are based upon long-term benefits for the state. They're not politically popular today. But in 10 years, when we have a robust transportation system, whoever's governor is going to be happy that we've made the decisions we made today.
Representative Sam Singh, how do your constituents feel about those increases?
Well, I'm open to the conversation on road funding. I think last time I was here, we talked about the need to take a look at our roads and our bridges and see the larger investment. It's an economic development imperative, but at the same time, we have to do it in a balanced way. You know, we're talking about registration fees that are going to potentially hit some of our low-income and moderate-income people significantly. You know, they've already taken hits in these last 2 years. You know, my seniors are paying now on their pensions. I've got people who are working 2-3 jobs who used to get an earned income tax credit at 20% of the federal level. That's now only getting it at 6%. And so they've all taken significant hits to be able to help the budget over the last 2 years, and I don't want to overly burden them. And so I'll be ready to have a conversation. I don't think the exact proposal that's been presented will be there, but I've also seen extreme measures. The Senate's already been talking about raising the sales tax, which is a very regressive tax. And so we're going to take a look at all the options that are out there, but my key consideration is that we don't burden middle class and families who've taken a huge hit over the last 2 years based on the decisions of this administration.
Democrats hammer, I don't think that's too hard a word, this administration's passage of a huge business tax cut and tax increases on pensions, cuts to education, the earned income tax credit. Could it be said that focusing on the business tax cut, as significant as it was, still conveniently overlooks the fact that the worst recession since the Great Depression preceded the business tax cut by several years, and moreover, that Michigan started its jobs decline quite a few years before that. Is it fair to hammer on that business tax cut the way members of your party do?
Well, we did. We had a very difficult decade as a state. We took significant cuts in revenue sharing to local communities. K-12 suffered. Higher education suffered. But the question came forward is this a job creator? And I've not seen the metrics from this administration to show that this is actually a job creator. I'm a pro-business Democrat. I've supported changes of the Michigan business tax. I didn't think it was a good tax when it was created a number of years ago. So I think we could have made changes. I would have been more supportive of actually giving tax credits to businesses that were hiring individuals instead of doing this blanket tax cut. I go back to lobbyists, I go back to law firms, I go to accountants who are not hiring new people, but they got a blanket tax cut from their business taxes. I'd rather have that revenue in the system helping our local communities who've cut firefighters and police officers. We need to be investing in those communities. We need to be investing in higher education. So if we could have done a business tax cut, I would have supported the governor and anybody who's interested in a tax cut to businesses that were creating jobs, but not blanket tax cuts that we don't necessarily see any long-term results on. Again, do these law firms need this tax cut? No. I would say that we should rather have those dollars and resources actually put into our schools, into our local community, so we can get the firefighters back to the level that we need, the public safety at the levels that we want as a state of Michigan.
Anything to that criticism, John Nixon?
Yeah, I mean, let me kind of, you know, I'd like to set the record straight. Everybody keeps talking that we've cut education. We're actually investing more in K-12 than I mean, when we started, we've actually added money to the K-12 budget. We're increasing, we've reformed the liabilities. We've saved the education system hundreds of millions of dollars because of what we've done. And so to say that we've cut education, I don't think is totally genuine. I know that message is out there, but I can show you the per pupil spending in the K-12 system when we started and where it is in our recommendation today. It is true that some of these areas that we had to cut to bring the budget into balance, but when you look at the tax system, businesses aren't going to come to an unstable tax environment. We had $1.5 billion annual deficit. We get money from our people. We take that very seriously. And when they don't know that government, when they don't have confidence in government, I mean, look at where Illinois is right now. They don't know how much their taxes are going to have to be raised. Businesses are not coming to that state. Businesses like to know that they have a stable environment to operate in. And so having a structurally balanced budget, having a tax system that makes sense, that's simple, fair, and efficient, provides economic stability. Now, I think it's a little bit disingenuous, too, to basically say, you've been here 2 years, you haven't added hundreds of thousands of jobs. I mean, how long it took us 8 years to get to where we got to, and now we're rebuilding the system. It's going to take some time to work out of this. But you know what? Things are improving. Unemployment rate's down. We're adding jobs, and we're making progress in this state.
One legislative question for Representative Sam Singh here. Speaker Bolger said yesterday that Republicans will not pass any bill requiring women to undergo transvaginal probes before an abortion. What did you make of that?
I mean, I was surprised that it even got brought up. You know, you would have thought that this, my Republican colleagues in the House would have learned their lessons from what was happening nationally and what they did over the last 2 years to women's rights and women's reproductive rights. You know, for trying to do something this divisive is inappropriate and wrong for that legislation to be brought forward. You know, I was pleased to hear the Speaker's comments on that this isn't something that's going to be moved forward, but it was, again, another shameful, throwaway to right to life by a handful of representatives, and I'm pleased that Speaker Bolger finally stood up to right to life and said, no, we're not going to have this kind of extreme legislation in our state.
Was that a conscious attempt, in your view, to appease members of your party here in the very pretty fractious atmosphere following Right to Work?
Well, I don't know. I've not had a chance to speak to the Speaker in regards to his motivation. I'm just taking him at his word that this is bad legislation. It does nothing for women and women's health, and it was just bad legislation. So if there was another reason for it, I'd have to wait for him to tell me that. But again, it was bad legislation in the country where it was looked at before, and I'm pleased that it's off the table. And it's, you know, it's time for us to stand up to extreme groups that want to push an extreme agenda on women's rights.
This has been a great, productive segment. We appreciate both of you being here. State Budget Director John Nixon, thank
Our
you.
Pleasure.
All right. Representative Sam Singh, we'll see you again soon.
Right. Thank
All right.
You.
Thank you.
Current state on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. The Spartans in Purdue tomorrow night in West Lafayette. Here to explain where the Spartan men's team stands is the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad. Are you driving to West Lafayette today, or did you have the foresight to be there already?
Yeah, I probably should have done that. No, I'm actually not going until tomorrow, so hopefully a lot of salt will have hit the roads and I'll be okay. But yeah, with a night game, I usually go day of if it's not too long of a drive and stay over that night.
Well, at least you're not driving today. I think that's the most important point.
Exactly.
I've got to ask you, what happened at Champaign last night?
Well, that's exactly I was going to bring that up, because where they are, of course, is in first place again, unexpectedly. I mean, the funny thing is, I'm a little embarrassed, because I was watching the game. It was an 8-point game. Indiana was shooting free throws, about 3.5 minutes left. I turned off the TV to go check on the kids, and when I came back, Illinois hit the winning basket. I said, what in the heck just happened? So I don't even really have a great explanation for you, although I did catch the highlights later.
Well, for those of our listeners who didn't catch it, Illinois beat Indiana last night, quite surprisingly. What's the takeaway from that? What does that do to the standings, and does it alter the Spartans' fortunes and Michigan's fortunes in any way?
Well, yeah, I think it brightens both of them, and it really hurts Indiana. I mean, Indiana now has a loss at home to Wisconsin and, a loss at Illinois. Obviously, Indiana beat Michigan State and Michigan at home, and the Hoosiers needed to do that, but, they still have to go to Ohio State. They have to come to East Lansing. They have to go to Ann Arbor. They still have to go to Minnesota. So, at this point, they look like, the third most likely team at best maybe to win this league, and of course things can change. But they go to Ohio State Sunday, and that's, you don't want to say a must win, but they've got to pick up a game at one of those places now to be there at the end. And Michigan and Michigan State, I would say, have a little bit better shot. Saturday is huge for both of them. I mean, Michigan State has to be able to handle Purdue and get past that game. But Michigan's at Wisconsin, one of the toughest games remaining on Michigan's schedule. And then, of course, they come to East Lansing Tuesday. So if Michigan wins Saturday, I would say Michigan, if you look at the remaining schedule, would has the most favorable schedule to the end.
Go a little deeper here with this Purdue-Michigan State matchup. What do we watch for here?
Well, there was some animosity between these teams. Michigan State beat Purdue in January by 23 points. Late in the game, Brandon Dawson and Travis Carroll got mixed up, and it looked like maybe Dawson threw a punch, or he started to throw a punch and stopped himself. The camera angle wasn't great. The Big Ten didn't punish him. Of course, Purdue fans and even Matt Painter basically said publicly, he was disappointed in that, and he said the tape speaks for itself. Michigan State didn't feel like Dawson punched. Last year, they already had issues. Of course, Brandon Dawson from Gary, Indiana, was Purdue's primary recruiting target for last year's class, and he came to Michigan State. And he had some words with Matt Painter on the sidelines in Michigan State's winning East Lansing last season. So that's a big story. The Purdue fans are going to be all over Brandon Dawson. And even though Purdue has not played well this year, I do expect the Boilermakers to be very fired up for this game.
The Spartans are not in the greatest physical condition by any means, but I do detect, it kind of sounds like cautious optimism with regard to Keith Appling's shoulder.
Yeah, I mean, it looked very scary late in Wednesday's game. I mean, it popped out on him, and of course he was, crouched and basically screaming in pain. They take him out, and he said as soon as he walked into the tunnel, it popped back in on its own, which is good, because the quicker that happens, the less chance of damage that you have. But it was still sore yesterday. He was able to practice. He said he'll definitely play. Now Michigan State's two primary guards, Keith Epp and Gary Harris, between them they have one shoulder that hasn't popped out this season, So, I mean, you consider all the other injuries in this team. I've never seen a team this banged up, and especially in one game, when Adrian Payne gets a nose, bloodied, Brandon Dawson twists an ankle, Appling, and of course Gary Harris is walking around with back spasms, and in between plays he can barely move. So I've never seen anything like that, really.
The Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad will be looking for you tomorrow night. Safe travels, Joe.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Coming up on the second half of Current State, it's the Midwest LGBT College Conference, College Ally Conference, that's happening at the Lansing Center. And we also catch up with former MSU quarterback Kirk Cousins on his NFL rookie year. That is all coming up on the second half of Current State. Stay close. I'm Mark Bayshore. Current State on WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. What's being billed as the nation's largest gay college conference will be held this weekend in Lansing, the Midwest Bisexual, Lesbian, Gay, Transgender Ally College Conference. Expects 2,000 people to attend at the Lansing Center. It was organized by students from Michigan State University and is open to all college students. There will be keynote speakers and dozens of workshops along with entertainment. WKAR Scott Pohl talked with MSU student Erica Scheckel, an organizer of the event. She says that while the issue gay marriage gets a lot of media attention, it's only one issue of importance to college students.
A lot of students actually are working on initiatives on their campuses for gender-neutral housing, so which is of particular importance to transgender students, as well as a preferred name policy, which again is also important to transgender students. Some of them are also working on things like funding for the LGBT resource centers, if they even have one, or establishing those, as well as establishing queer studies programs and things like that. So those are sort of the main issues that a lot of students are working on at their campuses.
For the most part, I would assume that marriage is in the future, or mm-hmm. the notion of marriage is in the future for these students. And so that's why I wondered if it was something that was the concern today, like, again, the media might have us think it is.
Marriage equality is certainly highly symbolic and incredibly important. But it is just one of very many very important issues. There's things like in Michigan in particular, you can be fired for being gay or transgender. There aren't employment discrimination protections for sexual orientation or gender identity. And so employment discrimination is really important, as well as a whole host of different issues, adoption rights, all kinds of things. And a lot of them are really tied together, but marriage is the more symbolic of them and the one that gets more attention, but there are so many different issues that are, you know, as important, if not more important.
Let's talk about one of those other issues that is getting a lot of attention right now and the degree to which it's catching fire, so to speak, with the college-age population, and that mm-hmm. has to do with scouting. This week, the scouts putting off a vote on allowing gay scouts and gay scout leadership. Is that an issue that college students are following, and what are you hearing about that?
Yeah, it's gay scouting is definitely an issue that college students are talking about. I have a number of friends, gay male friends, who were in Boy Scouts. I know people who were in Girl Scouts. And Girl Scouts currently is more accepting of individuals who are LGBT, not only a lesbian or bisexual, but also transgender. And that's been in the news a little bit. But Boy Scouts haven't been, because it's a private organization, it hasn't allowed gay individuals to openly participate in it. Although certainly, as proven by my friends, they've been in Boy Scouts. So it's very interesting, especially because it's a religiously affiliated organization. And even religiously affiliated organizations are starting to rethink their positions on different things and sort of begin to open up their arms to the LGBT community.
You touched on other issues that are of importance to gay and lesbian students and transgendered students. Mm-hmm. And so I want to make sure we talk about at least one or two of them. And it seems to me that housing issues on a college campus might be one mm-hmm. of them. Maybe not. I don't know if it's the issue aside from the others that we've talked about, but housing. Talk about how that's important to this group of students.
Yeah, gender-neutral housing is really important, particularly for transgender students or students who just aren't comfortable being in the same room with someone who is the same sex as them, and they might actually be in the process of transitioning. So it could be a really awkward situation. And so even actually at MSU, we just started a pilot program, I believe it was last year, for gender-neutral housing. It's only currently open to sophomore students and above, and it's only in certain select residence halls. But we're very much hoping that that program will expand to all of the residence halls. And so a lot of students are working on issues like that because there are a number of students who want to be in a living situation where they're comfortable. And if they're not in a living situation that's comfortable, then they might not be able to be as successful as they could be. So it's certainly an important issue, and it definitely affects their, you know, their academic performance.
How welcoming or unwelcoming would you say Michigan State is in two groups, the student population and faculty, staff, administration?
In my opinion, I think MSU is an incredibly welcome place. We had actually a campus climate study a couple years ago, and the study took place at MSU, but also a number of other universities. It was a nationwide study, and MSU is actually one of the most welcoming universities in the country, which is something we're really proud of. And just simply the fact that we have an LGBT resource center on our campus, we have an LGBT study abroad program. I actually was one of the ones who went on the first program last summer. And we have a number of other things that are moving forward. And we have 14 to 16 LGBTA organizations on our campus, including an organization for queer Christians, for people of color. We have a gay fraternity and a number of other organizations. So it's certainly very supportive.
I wanted to ask you if there's an active community of allies, straight allies, mm-hmm. on the campus.
Yeah, certainly. Even in the student organizations I work with, there are so many allies. I honestly don't know if someone is LGBT identified or if they're an ally. And to a great degree, it really doesn't matter because we're all on the same page and we do believe in fairness and equality and just being people and being friends and being college students. And there's a large number of allies who are in leadership, even leadership positions, not just part of the General Assembly, but leadership positions in these organizations. And even in the conference that I'm organizing, we have a number of allies.
Erica Scheckel is one of the organizers of the Midwest Bisexual, Lesbian, Gay, Transgender Ally College Conference in Lansing Friday night and also Saturday and Sunday at the Lansing Center. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Washington, please announce your selection.
With the 7th pick of the 4th round, number 102 overall, the Washington Redskins select Kirk Cousins, quarterback, Michigan State.
Uh-oh. Well, there he is. RG3, you've got company in trouble.
Well, former Spartan quarterback Kirk Cousins was back in Michigan yesterday headlining the MSU Club of West Michigan's third annual Spartan Winter Tailgate in Grand Rapids. Current State contributor Russ White caught up with Cousins yesterday, who told White that his time at MSU made him a man.
Well, I tell people that I came to Michigan State at 18 years old as a boy, and I left at the age of 23 as a young man. And those 5 years I had at Michigan State were as fundamental in terms of creating who I am and who I'm going to be as any five-year period in my life. I learned a lot about myself. I learned a lot about leadership. I learned a lot about what it takes to have success and to be excellent in this world at a lot of different things. And it's hard to put into words and sum it up in an answer to a question what it meant to me, but I will say it was a challenging time. It was a very fruitful time, and it was a time that will prepare me, or has prepared me, for what I'm going to face down the road, and not just football, but academically, and spiritually, mentally, emotionally, in every area of life. I was challenged, and I grew at Michigan State.
And Cousins says he developed his character at MSU too.
There's no doubt it was a challenge to balance athletics and academics. I feel like the greatest challenge at Michigan State wasn't to be a great football player, to be a great student. It was the character that it took to do those things, to operate with character, to conduct yourself with integrity so that you are accountable for your academics, you are accountable to your teammates. And there's no doubt it was a challenge, and Coach D'Antonio never sugarcoated it. But to the guy who's willing to take on that challenge and operate with character, you have all the resources you need to succeed. Between that academic center, the coaches, the academic departments, everyone was willing to work with you as long as you're willing to help yourself. And the person who's able to take the first step and be accountable, the job can get done.
Two tight ends, two wideouts for Kirk Cousins. Le'Veon Bell behind him. Steps back, pump fakes, looking to his right. Now looks over the middle, rolls to his right, trying to direct traffic and throw. Now fires. Caught inside the five by B.J. Cunningham. He's into the end zone. Touchdown, MSU! What a great ad-lib by Kirk Cousins to B.J. Cunningham for a Spartan score.
Well, I think it is important to remember where you came from, and I think the ability to look back and give back maintains a healthy perspective for looking forward. I think if you are neglecting where you've come from or you're failing to give back, whether it's your time, your talent, or your treasure, if you're neglecting to do that, I think you're setting yourself up for failure going forward because you've clearly lost perspective on what's gotten you to where you are. And to the degree that I can continue to give back, I think will continue then to help me moving forward.
Kirk Cousins under center. Starts to his left. Play fakes. Fires back in the end zone. Caught! B.J. Cunningham! Touchdown, MSU! What a play by the green and white!
For me, being a Spartan means operating with a high standard of excellence, regardless of the difficulties, the challenges that you may face. Being able to answer the call, rise to the occasion, and get the job done. And that was what my 5 years at Michigan State were about. No matter how much on paper it looked like it couldn't be done or it was too difficult to do, it was a matter of beating the odds and getting it done.
All the leadership skills Cousins honed at MSU guided him in his relationship with fellow Washington Redskins rookie quarterback Robert Griffin III this season.
With Robert and all the attention he gets and where he's at first I didn't know how to take it, and it rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. And so I, at first, just kind of said, I'll let Robert be Robert, and I'll be me, and we'll just kind of do our own thing. And I learned over time, as the season was progressing, this isn't the best way to do it. The best way to do it is to compliment Robert, encourage Robert, communicate to him how I'm his biggest fan and I'm in his corner. And that's how I'm going to be able to have influence on Robert or be able to have an influence on this team. And the second half of the season, I just decided I'm going to compliment the heck out of Robert and tell him how good he's doing every single time he makes a good throw. It's not going to be false, but every time he makes a good throw, I'm going to be the first one to say, Robert, that out route you threw there in that team period was phenomenal. That's big time. That's why you were the number 2 overall pick. You keep doing that, we're going to win a lot of games. Sincere encouragement I found in our relationship took off as a result. So it was that, again, servant leadership. Take your pride down. I know, Kirk, you want to be a starter. You'd like to be Robert. You're not right now. Rather than say, I'm going to do my thing and let Robert do his and never really have any influence or any relationship, lay down your pride, go over to him and swallow your pride and communicate to him, even if he's not going to give it back to you, if he's not going to be the same way back to you, keep loving on him, keep serving on him, and watch what happens. And I was able to watch what happened over the last 6 weeks of the year, and it was a pretty neat deal to grow in a relationship with him.
Cousins was excited when he got to play against the eventual Super Bowl champion Baltimore Ravens this past season.
I always said it'd be interesting to play Ray Lewis. I said Ray Lewis was kind of the biggest name in defensive football for all my years growing up. He's on the tail end of his career. I'm just coming in, but it'd be interesting to line up against him because as a quarterback, you look directly across into the eyes of the middle linebacker on just about every play. You identify who that is, you stare him down, he stares you down. So in terms of coming eyeball to eyeball with somebody as a quarterback, that's really the guy you have, and that's what Ray plays as middle linebacker. So Ray just won the Super Bowl the other day, so last game of his career. So we played the Ravens December 9th, and I circled the game. I thought, man, that'd be interesting to play Ray Lewis. And ended up getting into that game, but Ray had torn his tricep a few weeks earlier and was still getting back and wasn't fully healthy. So he was there in street clothes watching the game. So I didn't line up against Ray Lewis, but did play the Ravens. And so I missed him by that much. And actually on a 2-point conversion at the end of the game, ran in and scored. And Ed Reed, probably the next biggest name on that defense, will be in the Hall of Fame, one of the best ever to play this position. He was the one who met me at the goal line and hit me. And I still got across the goal line, but he hit me. And I remember walking off the field, and in the middle of the game, you're walking the field going, Ed Reed just hit me. That's pretty cool. I've come a long ways from Holland Christian. So,
thank you to the Spartan Network for the audio, and I'm Russ White for Current State on WKAR.
Touchdown, MSU!
And you can hear more from Current State contributor Russ White every Sunday afternoon at 4 on MSU Today. That's on AM 870 WKAR, or visit him at SpartanPodcast.com. It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The 55th Grammy Awards ceremony takes place Sunday night at 8 on CBS. Millions of eyes and ears will be turned to some of the world's most popular music that evening. Classical music, as usual, will be somewhat of a sidebar. The classical Grammys are typically announced off-camera in a separate awards ceremony. But the fact remains that the breadth and depth of classical music leads to a large number of categories, nominations, and awards. WKAR's Jody Knoll, Mark Schwitzgable, and Peter Worf are always tuned into the classical music scene. They got together in the WKAR studios earlier this week to review some of the Grammy Classical nominated recordings. Peter got the conversation started by noting some of the stylistic trends this year.
Sort of a heavy emphasis on contemporary 20th, 21st century-ish music and Baroque music, sort of two sides of a pendulum.
Yeah, definitely in the my category, the best chamber music, small ensemble performance, almost all contemporary. I think there's one piece of music that's before the 20th century. Everything else is 20th or 21st century. So a lot of it's pretty esoteric, pretty specialized. A lot of composers, I have to admit, I'm not familiar with. For example, the Boston Symphony Chamber Players, their nomination is for a CD called Profane et Sacré, or Profane and Sacred, and it's all 20th century French chamber music. Some of the recognizable works are the Introduction in the Allegro for harp, flute, clarinet, and string quartet by Ravel, and Debussy's Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp. Very nice performances of those. But the other three works are by Henri Tomasi, Henri Dudieu, and Francais, and those are pretty contemporary, so not for the weak of heart.
Mark, why don't you run with that chamber music category for us?
Sure. The Modern Mandolin Quartet, this is their first release since 2004. It's called Americana. It's probably the most recognizable, accessible of the five nominees. It has familiar works like Hoedown by Copland, The American Quartet by Dvorak, and Cool by Leonard Bernstein from West Side Story. Now, I love mandolin, but I have to say, this release, it's okay in small doses, but after a while, it starts to wear a little thin.
A little plucky on you?
Yeah, it just gets a little kitschy after a while.
Cool. Go. Crazy.
I don't know. It just...
A little goes a long way.
So that's a specialized taste for sure. I think my favorite of the releases that I in this category was by the Zofo Duet. This is a piano duet featuring Eva Maria Zimmerman and Keisuke Nakagoshi. They formed back in 2009, and this is their very first release. By the way, that title, Zofo, is apparently an acronym for 20-fingered orchestra. Z-O apparently stands for the number 20, and F-O is finger orchestra. And finally, Peter, a group that you're probably familiar with, given your time in Chicago, is 8th Blackbird.
You bet.
It's on the Sadie label, which is out of Chicago. This is the E.E. Cummings of modern contemporary music. They spell their name in all lowercase.
Right.
Based in Chicago. They actually won Grammys for their last two releases back in 08 and 2011.
That's Mark Schwitzgable with his look at the best chamber music small ensemble performance nominees for the 55th Annual Grammy Awards. Sunday night from Los Angeles. Jody is going to give us a look and a listen to the best choral performance.
It kind of skews either really old Baroque and Renaissance or really new and hyper-contemporary, and the choral category encompasses both extremes. Going to start on Wall Street with a performance of the oratorio Handel, Israel in Egypt by Handel, with Julian Wachner conducting the Trinity Choir Wall Street and the Trinity Baroque Orchestra. It's a phenomenal choir to be based at a church, and they do a lot of concerts as well and have made several recordings. Interestingly, if there were Grammys back in 1888, one of the very first recordings ever was of Handel's Israel in Egypt at the Crystal Palace Handel Festival. Some 4,000 singers. It was recorded on wax cylinder. And you can even hear that if you look up the Wikipedia article on Israel in Egypt. Another work, this is kind of getting into a lot of the works of Mark's category. This is a Requiem and other works by Ligeti. performance by the West German Radio Orchestra and vocal ensembles. This is very difficult, astringent music to listen to. I'll just say right off, it's at the bottom of my list. The final work in the classical best choral performance category is by Alessandro Strigio, the oldest and in many ways the biggest work of all of the choral nominees. Hervé Niquet made this recording of the work with Le Concert Spirituel in Paris's Notre Dame du Liban. 60 singers and instrumentalists around him in a circle, giving the recording a true surround sound effect, and the acoustics are superb.
That's Jody Noll walking us through the best choral performance category for the 55th Annual Grammy Awards coming up Sunday night. Okay, guys, I'm going to take the contemporary versus Baroque theory now and just destroy it with my category, because the best orchestral performance focuses on the big and sort of ultra-romantic. But it begins here with John Adams, Harmony Lara, and Short Ride in a Fast Machine. San Francisco Symphony, Michael Tilson Thomas, you have a very close association with the orchestra and its conductor with these commissioned works for the San Francisco Symphony, and in Thomas's case earlier, the Pittsburgh Symphony. These are driving, propelling, lush, and I'd say even romantic performances. It's a superb live performance. Like many in this category, we're talking about classical performance, and in several cases, these are live performances. The Mahler First Symphony is one of those. Features the Budapest Festival Orchestra, Yvonne Fischer conducting. Some classical writers are calling this a straight, no-nonsense performance. It's not a critical remark. There aren't a lot of surprises, but many commentators saying that's okay. It's played at the highest level, technically outstanding Mahler. And as I mentioned, this is also a live recording. I like it very much. Okay, here's my favorite. Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances, Valery Gergiev meets Rachmaninoff. To me, you can't beat the live performance, which this is. It's absolutely electrifying, ultra lush and romantic. So that's our look at the 55th Annual Classical Grammy Awards. Thank you, Jody Noll.
My pleasure.
And thanks to Mark Schwitzgable.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Warp.
I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to Current State. A couple of things from Current State that we're just learning of. The Associated Press reports a Louisiana power company says the cause of the Super Bowl power outage last Sunday night was a faulty electrical relay device, and that has been removed. It was not anonymous, the hacker group. So go ahead and console the anarchist in the next cubicle. Closer to home, the Michigan Supreme Court has suspended controversial Wayne County Circuit Judge Wade McCree. We've just learned of both of those developments in the last few minutes. Coming up on Monday's Current State, MLive's Angela Whitrock and I spend a half hour with Lansing developer Joel Ferguson. We'll get an update on the Red Cedar Gateway project and others. We'll get his take on important MSU business from his position on the Board of Trustees, and ask for his thoughts on Black History Month. That's Joel Ferguson for a full 30-minute segment Monday morning here on WKAR's Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Joel Instroth is our producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for his great engineering and to Gabby Saldivia for production assistance. WKAR's Director of Broadcasting is Gary Reed. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Have a great weekend.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA.
If you have any questions or comments about Current State, you can always email us at currentstate@wkar.org. Or if you'd like to join in on the conversation, follow us on Twitter @KAR Current State.